Hello, welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa, bringing you the News Gazette on this Wednesday, July 29th, 2026. Hope you're having a great day so far. Today on the front page is a bright, large, and colorful photograph of harness racers Wyatt Avenatti with his horse, Bullet Station, next to Connor Prather and his horse, You Light Up, and Jamaica Patton, riding Red Eye Boss as they crowd tightly together while rounding the corner during the first lap of the first race Tuesday evening at the Champaign County Fairgrounds in Urbana. Avenatti and Bullet Station finished the race at the top. And that'll have more of a story in section A7 that hopefully we will get to. The other article on the front page is about the election of 2026 with the heading GOP's AG candidate calls for Fed oversight of area voting. Fioretti has previously called for Ammon's resignation as clerk by Jana Wiersma. The Republican candidate for Illinois Attorney General has reached out to the U.S. Department of Justice to request federal oversight of the November election in Champaign County. Bob Fioretti announced the news at a press conference on Tuesday morning outside of the Champaign County Courthouse in Urbana. In his letter to the acting U.S. Attorney General Todd Blanche, Fioretti wrote that the federal indictment of Champaign County Clerk and Recorder Aaron Ammons puts the administration of the upcoming elections under a cloud. The people of Champaign County deserve a clean election, Fioretti said during his press conference. More than that, Champaign County voters deserve to have an election free of doubt and uncertainty. Under the present circumstances, without outside intervention, it is difficult to see how this can happen. Aaron Ammons, a Democrat, is charged with one count of conspiracy to obstruct justice and one count of obstruction of justice. He's accused of working with his wife, State Representative Carol Ammons, a Democrat from Urbana, to impede an investigation into her alleged misuse of campaign funds and state grants. Carol Ammons is charged with 8 counts of wire fraud, 1 count of providing a false statement to an FBI agent, and 1 count of conspiracy to obstruct justice. Both she and her husband are pleading not guilty. In situations such as this, it's been my experience that political opportunists try to obtain publicity for themselves by making statements without pending charges, said local attorney Steve Beckett, who is representing Aaron Ammons. And where I work is in the court system, where I will address and defend these charges on behalf of my client. The News Gazette also reached out to Illinois Attorney General's office and the county clerk's office, but has yet to receive a response. The Illinois State Board of Elections declined to comment. So did Champaign County Democratic Chair Deshaun Williams, who is also the mayor of Urbana. Fioretti previously put out a statement on July 8th calling for Aaron Ammons' resignation. Among other things, Fioretti's letter to the U.S. Attorney General's office cited issues that have occurred in previous elections during Ammons' tenure, including the 2020 primary. In March of 2020, the Illinois State Board of Elections reprimanded Clerk Ammons, a Democrat, for the following irregularities: premature tabulation of votes, failure to comply with election code provisions and best practices concerning mail voting, public testing of voter equipment, and the order of certain candidates on the ballots, he wrote. Fioretti said in his public remarks Tuesday that one alternative to federal oversight would be for Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul to intervene and accused him of being silent on this matter. Clean elections are not a partisan issue, Fioretti said. In his letter, he wrote that the midterm elections should be free and from interference, whether from foreign adversaries or domestic socialists eager to usher in the downfall of America as a free market capitalist society with liberty and justice for all. Both Ammonses are up for re-election in November. Carol Ammons is running unopposed, while Aaron Ammons will face Republican Alan Anderson. When asked for a comment, Anderson said that the recent indictment of the county clerk has understandably shaken public confidence. Whether federal oversight is appropriate is a decision for the appropriate authorities, he added. My focus is on restoring trust through competent, transparent, and professional administration. The county clerk's office is an administrative office, not a political one, and the people of Champaign County deserve a clerk who is committed to honesty, accurate elections, accountability, and excellent public service. Continuing on the front page, there's an article about We Reteach from Urbana. Teachers target closing post-pandemic math gap. Learning Center to utilize a blend of teaching strategies by Abasola Dahunzi. For academic professionals John Matanda, Sipama, and Johan Mufata, math isn't just a list of numbers printed on a worksheet. It's a part of daily life. Following Sipama's recent recognition as the News Gazette Teacher of the Week, the Urbana dual language educator is taking his classroom strategy a step further. In mid-September, Sipama and co-founder Mufata will launch We Reteach, a specialized learning center aimed at tackling post-pandemic math gaps for K through 12 students across Champaign County. The partnership between the two is rooted in the personal history that spans over a decade. When Mufata's family moved from the Democratic Republic of Congo to the United States in 2014, Sipama helped him settle into the community. Years later, that bond evolved into an academic partnership as Mufuta helped his younger siblings with homework while they attended Jefferson Middle School and Champaign Central High School. As a software engineer, Mufuta found himself thinking, there has to be a better way to explain this. I wasn't questioning the teachers, Mufuta explained. I was thinking about how technology and better instructional design could make concepts easier to understand. John brings the classroom perspective. He understands how children learn, and while I bring the systems and technology perspective. Sipama has been teaching since 1997, beginning his career in the Democratic Republic of Congo. He currently teaches a combined second and third grade French dual language classroom at Yankee Ridge Multilingual Elementary School in Urbana. When he moved to the U.S. in 2019, the teacher noticed that not only did many of his students struggle with math, but they also weren't motivated to learn it. His work comes as the Urbana School District continues to focus on student achievement in math and English, English language arts. According to its 2025 Illinois Report Card summary, the district's proficiency in English language arts continued to outpace math, while some elementary schools saw declines in math growth. The district said it plans to strengthen math instruction with additional evidence-based strategies. In the U.S., they start by teaching multiplication before division. In the DRC, however, Sipama said they start by teaching mental math. Instead of taking paper and writing down to find the answer, your brain gets there right away. To engage his students, he began blending U.S. curriculum with teaching strategies from his experience in French-speaking countries, including mental math and interactive games. The approach helped his students begin seeing math differently, not simply as a series of numbers and procedures, but as something that they could explore and enjoy. Soon, he said, students began sending him notes saying, "Papa John, we need more math." The center will launch exclusively with mathematics before expanding into literacy and STEM pathways. Sipama will lead the elementary programs, while Mufuta will focus on upper-level math, logic, problem-solving, and introducing concepts like coding and software design. As artificial intelligence continues to reshape the workforce, Mufuta emphasized that students will need to be able to link creatively, adapt, and use technology in practical ways. It's not about saying one system is better than another. It's about taking the best ideas from different educational systems, Mufuta said. He believes the numerical grades should be viewed as a stepping stone in a child's education rather than the sole measure of what a student can become. We want to teach children how to dream big, the engineer added. they achieve by holding on to their imagination and thinking critically so that they can adapt as the world changes. To ensure compatibility with local classrooms, SAPAMA has reached out to both Urbana and Champaign school districts to align the center's instruction with local textbook pacing and state learning standards. Sessions are tentatively scheduled for Friday evenings and Saturdays, broken into one-hour blocks featuring 40 minutes of instruction followed by 20 minutes of practical application. SAPAMA plans to cap the initial elementary cohort at 20 students to maintain small group focus. To keep the program accessible, the founders are likely seeking corporate sponsors, community donations, and partnerships with local churches or school districts for space. The initial sessions are planned to run out of a local church facility. For SAPAMA, success won't be measured solely by test scores, but by students' ability to command the material themselves. Every single day before I start teaching, I ask three or four students to go up and explain what we learned to the whole class, SAPAMA said. When they can use the strategy and teach it to their friends, that tells me they master it. Parents interested in intake assessments, schedule details, or program pricing for the mid-September launch can email SAPAMA at johnmatanda10@gmail.com. Inquiries should include the student's grade level, current math level, and primary language spoken at home. Let's head over to Section A6 in our communities with an article from Ford County Circuit Court. Ex-pharmacist gets 90-day jail term and probation, by Will Brumlevy. From Paxton, moments before she was sentenced to 90 days in the Ford County Jail and 30 months of probation, former Paxton pharmacist Jenna Vogel apologized for having stockpiled thousands of prescription pills in her Gibson City home, telling Judge Matt Fitton that she recognizes the potential harm of doing so. The regret that Vogel expressed near the end of a two-hour sentencing hearing in Ford County Circuit Court contrasted with State's Attorney Andrew Killian's characterization of Vogel as a defendant who has yet to accept responsibility for her criminal actions. According to Killian, judging by Vogel's own statements contained within both a pre-sentence investigation report and a psychological evaluation filed ahead of sentencing, her attitude has been, "It's not my fault. Someone else is to blame. I had no choice. Someone else should pay the price for this." Her attitude is, she's not responsible. While Killian argued for a prison term for 3 years and 9 months plus a $2,500 fine, defense attorney James Martinkus of Champaign asked for a term of probation for a 36-year-old Vogel, the one-time owner and head pharmacist of the since-shuttered Doug's Compounding Pharmacy, who pleaded guilty in April to one Class 3 felony count of possession with intent to deliver a controlled substance. Fitton, though, ultimately settled on a 90-day jail term and 30-month probation, along with a $5,000 fine. As conditions of her probation, Vogel was ordered to complete a cognitive thinking class and mental health and substance abuse evaluations and refrain from using alcohol or any drugs for which she does not possess a prescription. Vogel was taken into custody immediately and escorted to jail. She was given credit for 1 day already served when she was booked in jail upon her initial court appearance last year. Vogel was charged in February of 2025 with two counts, one a Class 3 felony and one a Class X felony, of possession with intent to deliver a controlled substance. The Class 3 felony alleged that Vogel knowingly possessed, with the intent to deliver, an amount of amphetamine on March 10, 2023, while the Class X felony, which Killian agreed to dismiss in April as part of a negotiated plea agreement, added that Vogel knowingly possessed, with the intent to deliver, 100 grams or more of a substance containing hydrocodone at the same date. Under truth in sentencing guidelines, Vogel had faced a sentence ranging from up to 30 months of probation to 2 to 5 years in prison for the Class 3 felony charge. In arguing for a 3-year, 9-month prison term, Killian noted, among other factors in aggravation, that Vogel abused her position of trust and authority as a pharmacist to acquire a cache of amphetamine pills that numbered in the tens of thousands. According to a complaint that led to the suspension of her registered pharmacist license by the Illinois Department of Financial and Professional Regulation, 43,893 controlled substances were removed from the Vogel home on March 10th of 2023 by investigators for the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration. We're talking about a systematic plan and conduct over the course of years, Killian said. Killian said a probation sentence would only deprecate the seriousness of the crime and not serve the means of justice. Killian said a prison term would be necessary to deter others from committing similar crimes. While Killian acknowledged Vogel's lack of any criminal history, he also noted her apparent lack of acceptance of responsibility. In both the pre-sentence investigation report from Ford County's Pretrial Service Office and psychological evaluation from Dr. Judy Osgood, Vogel never explained how she came to possess thousands of amphetamine pills in the home that she shared with her then-husband and 3 young children, Killian said. Instead of admitting that she took amphetamine from her own pharmacy, she only explained how she came to possess the hydrocodone, for which she is no longer charged, Killian said. Killian said Vogel's explanation for having the hydrocodone in her home was that largely self-serving and uncorroborated claim that her ex-husband, who allegedly was physically abusive toward her, threatened to harm her if she did not acquire it for him. In the pre-sentence investigation report, Vogel blamed her ex-husband for her current legal trouble, saying, "This is all his fault," Killian said. In arguing for a probation term instead of prison, Martinkus pointed out that the drugs were never illegally distributed in the community or inappropriately administered to her children either, as Vogel's ex-husband had reportedly claimed to the DEA. Martinkus also noted that Osgood, in her psychological evaluation of Vogel, indicated that Vogel does not appear to present a risk of harm to the public or to her children. Martinkus also pointed out that Vogel was indeed remorseful for her crime, as she stated in the pre-sentence investigation report that she feels the worst kind of guilt in the world. At the same time, Martinkus said Vogel acted under provocation from her ex-husband, who turned over the expired medication to the DEA after divorce proceedings were initiated as a way to get an advantage in the divorce. It worked, Martinkus admitted. Martinkus also mentioned Vogel's lack of criminal history and noted that she has already been punished professionally by losing her pharmacist license. "There's no reason to believe that she's going to commit another crime, either with drugs or anything else," Martinkus told Fitton. Martinkus also pointed out that Vogel's children, whom she has a close and loving bond, would be negatively affected by her absence if she is sent to prison. A prison term would also not help her deal with her depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder, Martinkus said. Another article in our communities about the Amtrak 391 in Arcola by Luke Taylor. Two hospitalized after train hits semi-trailer in Arcola. Two passengers on a southbound Amtrak train were taken to a hospital for evaluation after it hit the flatbed of a semi-trailer Tuesday afternoon at a crossing in Arcola, an Amtrak spokesman said. Mark Magliari said there were no reports of major injuries to any of the 67 passengers or crew members on the train. Videos posted on social media showed Amtrak 391. The Saluki service was passing through Arcola on its route from Chicago to Carbondale at 12:14 p.m. when it collided with a semi-trailer at a grade crossing. Magliari told the News Gazette that passengers heading to Mattoon and Point South were moved to a community building and then taken to their destinations on chartered buses. Two of them asked to be taken to a hospital from the community building. He said Amtrak was working with local law enforcement in investigating the incident. Lodging traffic charges against the vehicle driver is a decision made by local authorities, he said. Additionally, Magliari said that preventing incidents and fatalities is a priority for Amtrak. Continuing on under our communities, an article from Danville about a Danville traffic stop by Jennifer Bailey. Ex-Bloomington man gets 6 years for cocaine. A former Bloomington man has been sentenced to 6 years in prison for possession of cocaine. Judge Mark S. Goodwin handed down the sentence to Andrew Hill, 20, who pleaded guilty to possession with intent to deliver 15 to 100 grams of cocaine, a Class X felony, and obstructing justice, a Class 4 felony. He was sentenced to 3 years for the latter offense to be served concurrently and was also ordered to serve 18 months mandatory supervised release. During Hill's hearing, prosecutors with the Vermilion County State's Attorney's Office presented evidence that on March 10th, Danville police conducted a traffic stop in the area of Bowman Avenue and Main Street. Prosecutors said as the officer approached the vehicle and attempted to identify its occupants, Hill initially refused to provide his name, then identified himself as William C. Thomas and claimed that he could not remember his date of birth. The officer observed that Hill appeared extremely nervous and was sweating profusely. After attempting to verify the information, the officer determined that Hill had given a false name and asked him to exit the vehicle. At that point, prosecutors said, Hill immediately offered to provide information about another person who was allegedly in possession of illegal drugs. Officers subsequently identified Hill through his state ID card and determined that he had active arrest warrants. They arrested him and took him to public safety building. During transport and booking, officers observed Hill moving and walking erratically, consistent with someone attempting to conceal something. Correctional officers with the Vermilion County Sheriff's Department performed a pat-down search at the public safety building and claimed that they felt an object concealed near Hill's buttocks. A subsequent search recovered a softball-sized package containing two smaller bags of white chalk-like substances suspected to be crack cocaine. The substance field tested positive for the presence of cocaine. Hill denied ownership but told police that he uses cocaine and knew that it was a dealer amount of crack. The substance was sent to the Illinois State Police Crime Lab for testing. The results returned positive for 22.7 grams of cocaine. Let's head over now to the opinion section in A8 with an article by J. Mark Powell in his Holy Cow History. The title is, That Time Daylight Savings Was Moved Up. And there's a vintage black and white photograph of a worker as he checks for cracks in the Wrigley Building's terracotta facade and looks over the iconic clock's giant hands on April 3, 1977 in downtown Chicago. In an age when it seems Americans can't agree on much, one thing, and maybe just one, enjoys broad, popular support. Scrapping the twice-annual clock change, poll after poll shows a clear majority of Democrats, Republicans, and Independents who think it's time to stop the twice-annual pain in the neck. Congress is considering a bill that would make daylight saving time permanent. While this column never concerns itself with contemporary issues, the current debate makes this the perfect opportunity to discuss what happened the last time Congress changed the time change 50-plus years ago. And believe it or not, it all started in the Middle East. Now, really, it's true. On Saturday, October 6, 1973, a coalition of Arab nations unleashed a major surprise attack on Israel. It happened on Yom Kippur, Judaism's holiest day of the year. The Israelis were caught flat-footed, and initial Arab successes had them on the ropes. Things looked dicey until President Richard Nixon authorized a massive airlift to resupply the Jewish defenders. The attackers responded by following up with a long-promised threat. On October 17th, the Arab members of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries set in motion plans to cut oil output. With that, a new phrase entered the American vocabulary, the energy crisis, and America went into total freakout mode. It was arguably the largest single instance of mass public hysteria since the Cuban Missile Crisis a decade earlier. Congress in particular got its panties in a wad, driven by a persistently repeated ominous threat that the world would run out of oil and natural gas by the year 2000. Spoiler alert, it didn't. It rolled into action. It passed a slew of legislation intended to promote home insulation and energy conservation. And then it passed the Emergency Highway Energy Conservation Act of 1974, whose draconian effect was immortalized in Sammy Hagar's classic rock hit, I Can't Drive 55, imposing a national speed limit that stayed in effect for 13 years. By far, its most controversial step was passing the clunky-sounding Emergency Daylight Savings Energy Conservation Act of 1973. Starting at 2 a.m. on Sunday of January 6, 1974, the nation moved its clocks ahead 1 hour on an experimental basis. The theory was that an extra hour of daylight would save power with reduced lighting and heating. The same argument had been made 30 years earlier when the United States was placed on a year-round daylight savings time during World War II, with the only difference being that it was called wartime then. Then an interesting thing happened. Americans changed their minds in bulk. In the closing weeks of 1973, when fear of empty gas stations and power outlets without electricity was at its peak, 79% of Americans told pollsters they supported year-round daylight savings time. However, when alarm clocks started ringing in January and people were roused out of bed in pitch darkness, they began having second thoughts. Opponents pounced. They painted dark prospects in the minds of worried parents. Would little Junior, now trudging to the local schoolhouse in near-total blackout conditions, be embarking on a death march? Concerned civics groups even donated adhesive reflective strips to place on kids' coats as a safety precaution. Soon, people all around the country were whispering to one another, "Have you heard about all the kids killed walking to school in the dark?" Except there weren't. That is, there wasn't a noticeable increase in child-related accidents. Yes, some children were injured or killed, but no more than before. Researchers have been unable to document the often repeated claim that many children were hurt by the switch to daylight saving time. In the end, the whisper campaign's unfounded claims, coupled with mom and dad growling about waking up in the dark, swung public opinion against the change. By February of 1974, only 40% favored permanent daylight savings time, a nearly 40% drop in just 6 weeks. The experiment died a quick and quiet death. Congress pulled the plug on it, and the country returned to standard time as usual that October 27th. As for the energy crisis itself, it remained one of the great national boogeymen for the rest of the decade. No one can say precisely when it ended. It just sort of faded into the sunset sometime during the Reagan administration and was never heard from again. As if more proof that history repeats itself was needed, opponents of the current push to make daylight savings time permanent are again putting forth the exact same "children will be endangered in the dark" argument heard a half century earlier. You can't help wondering whether history would repeat even more should daylight saving time proponents wake up one cold wintry morning soon and discover, just as their grandparents did before them, that getting up when it's still dark outside, it really sucks. And we only have a little bit of time left in this first half hour of the News Gazette, so I'm going to another article in our communities about that Champaign County Fair, a royal household. Two sisters are crowned queen, Little Miss, at Monday's pageant, following in the older sister's footsteps. This is from Urbana, and here's a picture of the winners, Champaign County Fair Queen Caitlin Graham and Little Miss Jolynn Graham laugh as one final announcement rounds off the 2026 pageant on Monday night in Urbana. The winners are sisters, and very happy sisters. They are holding the floral arrangements and wearing a crown. And I'm going to take a break now. This is Lisa. We're going to return with our News Gazette in a moment.